Okay, it's a great pleasure for me to be here celebrating Gary's accomplishments to science and for also an opportunity to thank him for everything he has done for our community. I want to mention a couple of papers by Gary that were very influential for later developments. I think this one wasn't mentioned yet, but of course everyone knows it. When I was a student, I also particularly enjoyed reading this paper, so the paper on strings on plane waves, and I enjoyed it because it was so clear. So it was, I didn't need to know any fancy math, no complex manifolds, no Keller manifolds. Everything was understandable. And everyone has pointed out how much Gary has taught us general relativity and has communicated between different communities. And I wanted to show you this slide, which probably all of you recognize what it is, but there was a time where you could do a PhD in string theory and not know what this was. And Gary actually was the one who explained it to me and explained the symmetries of anti-de Sitter space and so on. Now, my talk today will be somewhat connected, and it will be clear at the end how it is connected to quasi-normal modes, which is some other aspect, which is, of course, well-known for relativists, a well-known aspect of black holes, which Gary also emphasized its importance and the need to study it to understand the approaches to thermalization and so on. Okay, so now I'll discuss, now I'll go back to the talk. So we know that according to, so the talk is about cosmology and cosmological perturbation theories. So we know that according to standard inflationary theory, the cosmological perturbations have a quantum mechanical origin, and they were created during inflation. And during inflation, the important parameter is the Hubble constant related to the potential through Einstein's equations, Einstein equation. And so the relevant modes have energies of order h and of order the Hubble. And this Hubble scale could be as large as 10 to the 14 GeV. So in some sense, we have a very high energy accelerator. And we can have collisions. So collisions are interactions of these perturbations during inflation. And these collisions leave a small imprint in the perturbations. And what I'll talk about today is about doing the so-called collider physics, so going from the signatures that we can easily see to the basic interactions that were present during inflation and the spectrum of particles during inflation. So we'd like to see what we need to look for to recognize new particles and to measure the masses and their spins when we look at cosmological observables. Now, if we consider collisions in flat space, this is it's well known how to do this. So you all know how this was done in recent experiments. And in cosmology, the object we would like to study are these non-Gaussianities in the cosmological correlators. And the study of this is, of course, interesting for the phenomenology of inflation. That's how I've motivated so far. But it's also interesting conceptually to understand how we reconstruct the past or the very early universe. How is the information about the early evolution in the wave function, late time wave function, or the probability distribution discussed by inflation? I mean, we've been studying S matrix theory a lot, and so scattering, even if we cannot directly measure, it's useful to think conceptually about scattering processes to learn about the structure of the theory, and so it's also interesting just conceptually to understand these cosmological correlators, even those that we cannot measure in the next 10 years, let's say. I'd like to make some analogy between observables in colliders, or QCD, let's say, and cosmology. So imagine you have a collision in chromodynamics at very high energies. So the things you observe are the hadrons. And the analogous thing in cosmology is we had this early inflationary phase, and the things we observe are, let's say, galaxies or CMB. This process of developing the late time universe is analogous to the process of hadronization. And In collision, we can measure energy correlators. So energy correlators are measuring the correlations between energies deposited at different angles on the detector. So they're a function of the angle on the detector. We have the analogous cosmological observables, correlators of primordial density fluctuations. In both cases, we have weak coupling at high energies, and also the theory is weakly coupled during inflation because the because H is much less than M Planck, and that implies that the gravitational field is weakly coupled. In both cases, we have an approximate scale invariance. So we have here the approximate scale invariance of QCD, and here we have the approximate scale invariance of the wave function, or which is the same as the approximate De Sitter invariance during the Sitter phase, the Sitter inflationary phase. And here we can consider something we can call the operator product expansion of energy correlators, which is to look at these energy correlators at very small angles on the detector. And that's analogous to squeeze limit of primordial correlators. I'll discuss this a little more, but it's to look at primordial correlators at where you have high ratios of scales. So one, you have two that are very close and one that is very far away, for example. And in both cases, the time evolution is imprinted into the scale dependence of the observables. So as you look at things at shorter and shorter angular distances, for example here, or shorter angular distances in the sky, we are looking at things that happen later. We look at bigger angular distances, we are looking at things that happen earlier during the evolution. And both of these are controlled by the slightly broken conformal symmetry. The manifestations of this conformal symmetry in detail are slightly different, but they are both controlled by the same symmetry. Now, the basic observable we are going to be discussing is the primordial curvature perturbations. So the idea is that so we had inflation, then inflation ends, and at the end of inflation, we can look at the spatial slice of the universe with constant density, or and that slice is not flat, so it would be flat in the homogeneous universe, but due to these fluctuations, it has some small curvature, and that small curvature is this small curvature perturbation we are going to be talking about. So here, x is are the spatial directions of that slice, and zeta is essentially the deformation of this slice, so scale factor of this slice. Now, it's often common to think about this. One more thing I need to say. So early in the evolution of the universe, this variable was very quantum mechanical, but by the time inflation ends, this variable is purely classical and has some classical statistical distribution, and what we are looking at are correlations of those classical random fields, which originally were these original quantum variables. Okay, so we can, some simple facts about kinematics. So we can do the Fourier transform in the spatial directions and think of these variables as functions of momenta, and I will do that through the rest of the talk. And these momenta have to obey the momentum conservation condition due to the statistical homogeneity of the universe. So this is similar to the dependence of momentum of amplitudes. The only difference is that there is no energy conservation, so there is nothing that tells that the sum of the modulus of the momenta should be zero. Of course, the leading effect is the two-point function, which we obtain by processing the two-point function for a scalar field in the Sitter, so that's the leading approximation. And this two-point function is completely determined by the scaling symmetry. It has this form in momentum space and that other form in position space. Now, we are going to be interested in understanding the effects of particles that could have existed during inflation. They could have gotten excited during inflation and then decayed. They could have decayed to the inflaton. And if you had, so we're going to be interested in processes where inflation produces a massive particle. So we imagine we have another massive particle with a mass comparable to the Hubble scale so that it could have been produced. And so this will happen if we have another field beyond the inflaton, and we'd like to recognize the existence of these other fields beyond the inflaton. Of course, now we have many fields. So you can ask, well, what are all the fields we have today where during inflation? So we might imagine there were other fields beyond the inflaton. So of course, those all the fields we know now might have been extremely massive, but it's also reasonable, and I'll give some reasons for thinking there could have been other fields with masses comparable to H. Okay, so in this situation, this massive field will contribute to the four-point function. And one, in a four-point function like this, so we have the momenta of each of these observable quantities, and we can, the momentum of this particle here will be given by the sum of the momenta of these two. So we can define this k intermediate directly in terms of observable quantities as the sum of the two momenta. And an interesting regime is to, so this is a regime which will contain the information about the direct information about the new particle, is the regime in which the intermediate momentum is much less than the other momenta. That physically corresponds to a situation where we consider a cosmological correlator, where we have we take the four-point function and we divide it in two pairs, and the two members of the pair at short distance relative to the distance between the two pairs. So that's analogous to an operator product expansion. It's essentially almost the same as an operator product expansion in the three-dimensional slice. And in this regime, the four-point function turns out that when you do this calculation, this four-point function has a structure which depends on the ratio of the long to the short distance momentum to some powers which depend on the mass of the field. So I'll, the next slides, I will discuss various aspects of this formula that you compute in this regime. So the first point is that we see this clear oscillation as a function of the log of the scales. And this oscillation is nothing else than the oscillation of this massive field. So when you have a massive field, the wave function of the massive field oscillates and with a phase proportional to the mass. And that's what we are seeing here. So this is the number of e-folds that, well, this is the e to the number of e-folds that has happened since the field was created till it decayed. In addition, we see this Boltzmann suppression. So this is a, this is the approximate formula when mu is large. There is a more sophisticated formula for mu is comparable to zero. Yeah, this Boltzmann suppression, it's interesting because the temperature, the beta of the Sitter space is 2 pi. So here what we get is pi. So it's an effect which is slightly larger than the Boltzmann factor. And that is due to the fact that this is an interference effect. So what we're seeing here is an interference effect between the part of the wave function where we don't create this pair of particles, the pair of massive particles, and the part of the wave function where we did create the pair. Okay. If we ask what's the probability of creating the pair, then we square this part of the wave function and we get the usual thermal factor. This is an effect slightly bigger. And so it's an interference effect. And because it is an interference effect, we see some dependence on the direct phase of the wave function of a massive particle. So normally we don't see this dependence on the wave function of a massive particle, on the oscillation as a function of time. But here we actually see it because we are really sensitive to the phase difference between these two parts of the wave function. And it's an interesting test of the quantum nature of the fluctuations. So if these fluctuations were produced by some classical random process, we might not expect this particular phase. In fact, this phase is actually, there's the fact that it oscillates, but there's also the fact that the phase of the oscillation is given, is calculable and depends only on mu, so only on the mass of the particle. So we, one predicts a phase with a very specific time dependence, so a very specific origin somehow. So the phase of the phase is fixed. If the intermediate particle has spin, then there will be some interesting angular dependence on these various momenta. So there are these large momentum k1, which is almost the same as minus k2, and similarly for k3 and k4. So the functions could depend on the angle between k1 and k2, and also between on the angle between k1 and the intermediate momentum here. And again, this is further evidence of quantum mechanics, as this was seen, because we have the correlations between spins. And now, the correlations between spin is it's a bit interesting, it has an interesting aspect. So if we create two particles here in the sitter space, and let's say one was a charged particle, if there were a charged particle, we would expect one to have charge plus and the other one to have charge minus. So these are two members of the pair. And now if they have spin, and one is spinning this way, which way do you think the other one will spin? Okay. That's the right answer. I don't know. I'm sure Gary thought that this was the right answer. And, well, this is the answer that comes from this familiar formula. So one way to understand this answer is, so if you imagine the pair of particles that got created and then goes to later times, so the spins would be opposite when they are created, but as they evolve, they become parallel. There is a more symmetry-based explanation for this by thinking about the part of the conformal symmetry which is unbroken once we select the position of these two particles, and those symmetries rotate around the two points in opposite ways, therefore the spins should be in the same way. I'm pointing this out because I expected the opposite, and when the formulas were giving this answer, I'm sure Gary wasn't confused about this. And this is, again, goes back to this familiar formula, and well, there is an even more familiar formula, perhaps in two-dimensional conformal field theories, that when you consider the correlator of two operators, actually the two with the same spin, that is non-zero. And the reason is, again, the same conformal symmetry, and so on. Okay, so that was a side remark. So the four-point function that we've been discussing so far has a very small overall coefficient. If you assume that the interactions, so of course the overall size of this four-point function depends on the coupling between this new particle and the inflaton. But if you make the reasonable assumption that this coupling is gravitational, that's somehow the smallest coupling we can imagine. And as long as there is no symmetry that protects, there could be a symmetry that sets this coupling to zero, but in the absence of any symmetry, we expect this coupling to be of order of gravitational size. And that would give a small overall coefficient of the form H over M Planck square. And so, no, this is just for the decay dependence. So in the natural units, I'll be a little more precise later. Just to, so the overall size is small. So it's a factor essentially of H over M from each of the two interactions. And so the question is whether we can find a bigger effect. And we can find a bigger effect if we consider the three-point function. So in a pure de Sitter, we can't, but in the case of an inflationary universe, we have this time-dependent classical background. And so what happens is that one of the, you can replace one of the quantum fluctuations by the big classical background. And that has the effect of having now only one overall small coupling, so only a factor of H over M Planck in front. I didn't write it here, but there's only one factor. So it's a bigger effect, still very small. And one modification relative, so the calculation of this is almost identical to the previous one, and with one modification being that now the momentum of this guy is zero because that's the classical background. And so now the momentum of the intermediate one is equal to the momentum of one of the external particles or one of the external curvature fluctuations. And so the kinematics is a little simpler, but nevertheless, we still have a large momentum and a small momentum, and we can have these factors, these oscillatory factors for real mass and for real mu. And they have the same features as the ones we were discussing for the four-point function. Even in the case that the intermediate particle has spin, there is still here some angle, and we can have some a non-trivial dependence on that angle. Now, going back to Gabriele's question, so if you look at the three-point function produced by standard inflationary three-point functions, so a scalar field plus their interactions with gravity, you get some answer. And that answer, well, this is what I call the usual answer, including there is also a factor of H over M Planck. And then these are extra factors that, in general, will suppress the amplitude. will suppress this more because K3 is small compared to K1. So this is something decaying. And the real part here, these three halves, represents the dilution of the particles due to the of the massive particles due to the expansion of the universe. The fact that these three halves as opposed to three is again the fact that we are seeing an interference effect. We're seeing the wave function rather than the square of the wave function. So the square of the wave function, which is the density of these particles, dilutes like a factor of three, but here we are seeing the factor of three halves. Yes? The phase? Yeah, so the phase of the oscillation is, so okay, so yeah, let me be a little more, yeah, that's right. This, yeah, so people have, yeah, well, Eva and collaborators have discussed possible oscillations in the two-point function that could be produced, for example, by oscillatory features in the potential. So if you see an oscillatory feature, you might wonder, I mean, if you see some oscillation in the physical answers, you might wonder, well, it might be that it's not this quantum mechanical business that I'm discussing here, but it might be just an oscillatory feature of the potential. Now, there is an important difference between those oscillatory features, the oscillatory features that come from the potential, and this one. So in the oscillatory features of the potential, the phase of the oscillation is synchronized with the overall time evolution in the, or some overall scale in the universe. So if you wish, they depend only on the absolute, they depend on the phase depends on the absolute time. While here, the phase of this oscillation depends on the ratio between two scales. So if you vary the ratio, so you consider K3 over K1 to be some number, and you vary that number, you expect to see exactly the same phase value. While if it was due to some other oscillations, then you would see something that would depend on the fact. Well, yeah, it probably does. So I think it would have some, probably some oscillation. I suspect so, but I'm not sure. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. We were trying to look for signatures of the new particles, and if you look at the two-point function of the power spectrum, for the reason you are just bringing up, it's not a signature. It's not a direct signature of a new particle. So now another point we like to make is that, of course, you can have self-interactions of the inflaton. So you can have a situation where you have a 5 to the 4th term in the potential, for example, or even with derivatives, and that will give rise to a non-trivial four-point function. But that four-point function will not have this particular behavior in this squeeze limit. So the squeeze limit is directly sensitive to the new particles. Okay. Okay. Now, one can consider not only the contributions from a single particle, but perhaps from pairs of particles. That could arise when we have a field which cannot couple to a pair of inflatons due to some symmetry reasons. So for example, imagine that the green lines are the Higgs field, and then we have the electroweak symmetry is unbroken. So so just the gauge invariance forbids the direct coupling, but we can have a coupling of a pair of Higgses. And this also gives an effect in this regime, and it just gives an effect which is a faster decay, because we have the product of the things we had before. We have factors here which have twice the exponent we had before. So here, the story is that we have a long-distance fluctuation, and this, due to the interaction with the background, creates this massive particle with a massive particle, which then decays, and then the decay products interfere with the original wave function, and that's what we are computing. And as I mentioned before, it's a striking evidence of quantum mechanics, and the phase of the oscillation is calculable, and you can think of this as a kind of cosmological double slit experiment. So we have two alternative evolutions, one producing the particle, one without producing the particle, and we see this interference effect. So in summary, so in a collider, we would find particles by looking at the peak in the invariant mass distribution, as we saw in the Higgs example in the transparency. the first one of the first transparencies. And in cosmology, we'll look at the peak of the Fourier transform of cosmological correlators as a function of this L, so the ratio of these two. And of course, we can also have some angular dependence from the spin. Now, how difficult is it to detect this, this effect? So in order to get an idea, we can compare it with the standard three-point function. By the standard three-point function, again, I mean the one produced by a single field inflationary theory. And that standard answer can be viewed as the same as what we're discussing here, except that the exchange particle is a graviton. Now, that standard answer can be parameterized in terms of some quantity that people call FNL. And the answer produced by inflation is has a value which is has to do with the slope of the spectrum. So it's pretty small, it's a few percent. While the experimental constraint is about 5. So we're still two orders of magnitude away from detecting the standard, the answer produced by standard inflation. This one has extra factors. Well, it has the Boltzmann suppression factor and also extra factors of K3 over K1, which both suppress the answer. So it's harder to detect. And in order to detect, therefore, the number of modes, so all these observations are constrained by cosmic variance, so the fact that we are observing only a finite number of modes. And we need to increase the number of modes as the square of this factor. So it would require looking at other probes of primordial fluctuations, such as the 21 centimeter observations, which are sensitive to more modes and to smaller scales. Of course, those are things that are in the future. So it's not these effects we're discussing here. If the couplings are gravitational, as we have discussed, are not going to be measured in the next 20 years, but perhaps they will be measured not so far. No, so far in the future. Now, yeah, that was the last line. Yeah, the this was this was the kind of more pessimistic scenario, but we could also have some interactions which could be larger than gravitational, and so you will get some constraints on these couplings. And, yeah, that's right. It's true. So you can ask. I had that transparency on that, but I cut it out. So you can ask. Imagine we were able to see all the modes, right? So how big a mu could you possibly detect? It's a mu of about 60. It's the same as the 60 of the 60 e-foldings. And it's a mu of about 60 means that it's a particle whose mass is 60 times bigger than Hubble. So it's still much less than the Planck mass, right? There is five orders of magnitude between one and the other, between H and Planck. So it's just 60 bigger than H. So that's what, through this technique, in principle, you could detect. Yeah. In principle, impossible to measure using this technique, yeah. So where this is conceptually important, I don't know, because one could argue that you could measure Planckian modes directly by building an accelerator today. But certainly, it is an interesting point that that maybe talking about these Planckian modes during inflation, maybe it's not directly accessible to observations we can make today. Whether this is relevant for constructing the theory of the early universe, I don't know. And I think I'm not doing very well in time. Let's see. There is an interesting bound on the spin and so on, but the one point I wanted to make is that so of course this whole calculation is governed by the conformal symmetries or the isometries of the sitter. And if we have a correlator in a four-dimensional field theory in the sitter, in a non-conformal field theory, it's just an ordinary massive theory, it's invariant under the sitter isometries, and at late times, these de Sitter isometries can act on the coordinate as conformal symmetries. And if at late times we can often expand the field as in terms of powers of time, so powers of eta, then the coefficients of the operator, so these are other operators, so this is the four-dimensional operator, And these are operators we can view as operators in the three-dimensional theory. Then they will transform as a three-dimensional operator of conformal dimension delta. Of course, this fact was important for the SCFT, but here this is a generic fact which is not relying on a dual CFT. This is just an operator in the original theory. And this is true for whatever operator we are doing. So it could be a single particle operator. It could be a composite operator consisting of two fields. And in all cases, we can expand the operator in terms of these powers. And the powers that appear here, so this leads to an expansion in the correlator in terms of powers of this kind. And the powers that appear here are the energies of quasi-normal modes in the sitter static patch. So those are the powers that are governing this. We didn't fully prove this. This was an experimental observation plus hand-waving argument that this is what one should expect. So that's the connection to the quasi-normal modes I was promising in the beginning. So these cosmological correlators in this limit, they have this power series expansion. And the point is that the energies, if you wish, or the exponents that appear in this power series are directly the quasi-normal modes of the sitter. So that's the conceptual, that's the conceptual point. And in principle, if you can see all of them, you get the full information about the sitter. Of course, in practice, you only see a small part. Now, I should emphasize that this operator product expansion region of the correlator, so when K3, let's say, is much less than K1 and K2, is not where the largest non-Gaussian signal is. So if you are going to be interested in asking the question of whether there is non-Gaussianity or not, you would not necessarily look in this region in the beginning. You would look in other regions, and you would see there first the non-Gaussianity. But if you want to ask where there are new particles, then this is the region to look at. Okay, well, conclusions. So non-Gaussianities in cosmological correlators have very interesting information, and they have very interesting evidence for the quantum nature of the fluctuations. And of course, it's very useful for analyzing this to think about the conformal symmetry or the late time implications of the sitter isometries. And this could be perhaps observable with futuristic experiments. This 21 centimeter tomography seems to be the most promising one. And the evidence for new particles will only come after seeing other non-Gaussian signals. Well, happy birthday again, Gary, and thank you for all your contributions. Yeah, I didn't. Right. So mu, yeah, maybe I should go back to the corresponding transparency. Let's see. What happened? Okay, well, anyway. Yeah, so there were two terms. And if mu is imaginary, that would be the case when the mass is small. Then you have two terms, so with two different exponents. And the exponents would be real, and one would be bigger than the other. And so, of course, you would see one first. But if you were able to see one and then the second, everything I said about the relative phase or the relative factor between these two being fixed is still valid. And the fact that you need to see both and so on is also valid. These small values of the mass are, in some sense, more observables. They lead to a bigger signal because this suppression is smaller. And when you go all the way to m equal to 0, when the mass is 0, the exponent in one of them becomes 0. So it leads to an order 1 effect in this squeezed limit. And so those are, I pointed out several references. People have been studying this squeezed models for quite some time. And especially in the massless limit, they give a big signal. And so there is a way to constrain the existence of a new field during inflation. And this is more directly studied, and we'll get information about those scales in the near future. I mean, there are already some constraints. And those constraints are fields where you have massless fields. So a case with massless fields is the very light fields. I forgot to mention one reason for thinking about the existence of these light fields that was given by, I think, Baumann and Green, was that if you have, for example, a theory which is a supersymmetric theory and spontaneously broken so as to generate the cosmological constant, then you have the partners of the inflaton will have a mass of order h. And that's a concrete example, a reason for thinking about other fields during inflation. Yes. Yeah, so there are two cases you could consider when you have multi-field inflation. One is whether the effects of the second field survive today. So for example, if there are fluctuations not only in the overall curvature of space, but there are also fluctuations in the relative number, let's say, between dark matter particles and baryons, for example. So those modes are more directly measurable, and so far they are not present, but they could be seen in the future. So that's a more direct evidence of a new field. Those effects you can even see in the two-point function. You could have a second field, but that was present during inflation, that was very light or massless, but did not survive till today, so that all the things we see today depend only on a single combination of the fields. In that case, the leading effect comes from this squeeze limit of the three-point function, and people are directly trying to measure this. So we will get constraints on these light fields, even if they do not lead to isocurvature fluctuations. No, not too much. I mean, here we consider the contribution of one field at a time. In the real world, we'll get all the contribution from all the fields, and if there is a very light field, it would be very difficult. It would be more difficult to see the contribution of the massive fields. So. Yes. Well, not really. I mean, if we look at the diagram that I think Evert Ashteker was drawing, so where there was the static patch and then there was radiation going out, right? So you can think of these quasi-normal modes as roughly speaking, yeah. And then so they have some influence in the far future, right?